You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. This is the Blizzard edition, January 22nd, 2016, of This Week in Cardiology. This week, I'm going to talk about persistent atrial fibrillation and ablation, complete versus infarct-related artery-only PCI and STEMI, primary prevention ICDs in women, measuring blood pressure, and the moonshot cardiovascular disease. I'm going to try something different this week and go without slides, just talking. So let's start with persistent AF and ablation. The Cleveland Clinic group of electrophysiologists published a single-center observational trial in Circulation EP in which they studied the time interval between the diagnosis of persistent AF and first ablation procedure. Not surprisingly, they found that the longer the delay, the worse the ablation outcomes. Longer delays correlated with elevations of the BNP, CRP, and LA. Now, this was a good-sized study of 1,200 patients ablated between 2005 and 2012. The intuitive, fast-thinking, easy take is that earlier is better. Let's get these patients ablated because they do better with ablation. But I don't think that's the case at all. And to the author's credit, they spend a great deal of time in a discussion section outlining the limitations of this study, including the fact that numerous patients had missing data on the exact onset of the persistent AF. So good on the authors. But here's why I lead with it. This is an important study, and the authors talked about this in their discussion, linking substrate and persistent AFib. And that is important because now we know that atrial substrate is modifiable, not with ablation, but with aggressive risk factor modification. So if you want better outcomes in patients with persistent AF, you have to combine aggressive risk factor modification with an ablation strategy. Next topic starts with a case. This is an acute myocardial infarction, an LAD infarct gone to the cath lab. The LAD is occluded, but there's also an 80% right coronary lesion. And the question is, what do you do with the RCA lesion? Do you leave it for medical management, or do you do complete revascularization? Remember a couple of years ago, the Choosing Wisely campaign had a strong recommendation to do infarct-related artery intervention only. But that recommendation was based mostly on observational data. The CULPRIT trial came along. This was an RCT, which compared complete revascularization to infarct artery only PCI. And that study reported significant reductions in major adverse cardiac events with complete revascularization, a 50% relative benefit. Now, the study wasn't powered to detect mortality benefits. The most recent study that I'm going to talk about and published in JACC is a CULPRIT sub-study. This was a sub-study in which the investigators used CMR imaging technology to look at the infarct sizes and what happens in the two different strategies. And what they found by doing CMRs at about 3 days after the intervention was that overall infarct size was about the same. But concerning was that there was CMR-detected areas of infarct in the non-infarct-related artery territory. So intervention outside the area of the infarct was associated with abnormal images, which is, of course, concerning. Two comments on this study. One is that this seems to me a great question to ask in a bigger RCT, or perhaps could we even do this in a pragmatic type trial? The second comment I have is about guidelines, and I hope the future of guidelines is more gentle and more cautious. I mean, to me, what this says is that a simple binary yes or no proclamation about what to do in a complicated cath lab situation is going to be difficult. I'm no interventionalist, but I can see multiple different scenarios that would push an interventionalist into complete revascularization in one case and not in another case. And how can a global guideline statement address that? Guidelines should be more cautious, I think. Next topic is the issue of primary prevention ICDs in women. So we know that the RCTs are clear-cut. They show a significant mortality advantage in selected patients with heart failure with primary prevention ICDs, but women were underrepresented in these trials. So can we generalize the findings of those trials to women? This is the question. Now, observational studies after the RCTs and meta-analyses have been done, and they've actually yielded conflicting results. Some show benefit for women, others not so much. And this was the question that a group of researchers led by the Duke Clinical Research Team tried to answer with the Get With The Guidelines database. And what they did was they took 400 women with heart failure who had ICDs and 400 women with heart failure who didn't have ICDs, and they did a comparative effectiveness comparison. Now, this wasn't a randomized comparison, so they had to use propensity matching to try and account for the variables. They did the same sort of comparison in men, and what they found was that similar to the RCTs with ICDs, this study showed that there was about a 20%, a little bit more than 20% relative benefit in mortality with the ICDs in women. And the magnitude of that benefit and the Kaplan-Meier curves look similar in men and women. So these findings support the gender neutral guideline statements. Now, of course, propensity matching is not the same as an RCT, and there's no way that propensity matching is going to account for all of the variables that go into an ICD decision in these patients. But as the authors of the paper point out, that we're never going to get an RCT in women only for ICDs. I don't know if this is correct, but when I talk with female patients who are considering a primary prevention ICD, I mentioned the fact that women were underrepresented in the trials and that there may be more uncertainty in the ICD decision in women than in men. Next topic is the issue of measuring blood pressure. If the word pragmatic is in the title of a trial, I'm going to get a little interested, especially when it comes to accurate measurements of blood pressure. Now, you know the problem that a single point measurement in the office of a blood pressure may not be indicative of true high blood pressure. But it's also true that getting a 24-hour home ambulatory blood pressure monitoring is a burden. So the question is, could simply just having a look at a patient's listing of the blood pressure recordings be useful? And this was the question that a group of investigators from, check this, Tasmania and Poland asked. Now, this isn't the normal areas that I talk about in this podcast. So this group of researchers took a group of patients and they said, we're going to look at their home blood pressure monitoring recordings, and we're going to compare that to 24-hour ambulatory recordings. And they found that if 3 out of 10 blood pressure recordings were elevated, then that was pretty predictive of high blood pressure on a 24-hour ambulatory recording. The positive predictive value was about 85%. And importantly, patients who had these high blood pressure readings also had evidence of end organ damage of high blood pressure. So I mentioned this study because, number one, it's pragmatic and it's useful and it's easy, and I love that. But also, this is an important topic, the whole issue of accurate measurement of blood pressure. Now, my theories of why there's so much harm in overtreatment of high blood pressure, especially in the elderly, is these spurious recordings in the office. Patient comes in the office, gets a high blood pressure reading, gets treated with medications, but really doesn't have true high blood pressure, and then gets problems with low blood pressure. And I'll bring you back to the SPRINT trial, which of course showed that more aggressive blood pressure control was better. But keep in mind how blood pressure was measured in SPRINT. In SPRINT, patients came in and sat quietly in a room for 5 minutes, and then their blood pressure was averaged over 3 different recordings. Now, I don't know about you, but that doesn't get done in my office. So here we have a study that shows that looking at home blood pressure monitoring, looking at it and getting a gestalt is a pretty useful strategy of getting to more accurate blood pressure recordings. Final topic, I want to bring up an excellent feature by Dr. Melissa Walton Shirley, my colleague at theheart.org on Medscape. Melissa is a great writer. She's passionate about cardiovascular health. And she's written a beautiful post about this whole business of spending millions of dollars on the cardiovascular moonshot. And I think she's worried that all of this money is going to go into procedures and medications. And she's a huge proponent of health literacy and believes that if we can educate people at a young age about health literacy, they'll live more healthy lives and cardiovascular, and that will be the best way to achieve cardiovascular prevention. So that's it for This Week in Cardiology. I want to remind you that to look at this podcast and other podcasts, you can go to www.medscape/TWIC. Until next week, this is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.